You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Katie Frankowitz. The Chinook Indian Nation says it will continue fighting for federal recognition after the Supreme Court declined to hear its case this week. The Chinook Nation represents five tribes along the mouth of the Columbia River. It has been fighting for federal recognition for generations. It briefly gained it in 2001, only to have it stripped less than 2 years later. Its petition to the Supreme Court was the latest step in its fight to restore federal recognition. Chairman Tony Johnson said in a statement that the nation's next steps include seeking action through Congress and repetitioning the Bureau of Indian Affairs. City leaders in Rockaway and Tillamook County are asking drivers to remain attentive, patient, and mindful of pedestrians, cyclists, and families enjoying the area during spring break, after an alleged vehicle versus pedestrian accident resulted in one person being stabbed. According to the Tillamook County Sheriff's Office, a pregnant woman was carrying her 2-year-old son and walking with her husband at the Rockaway Beach wayside when she was struck by a Jeep in the parking area. The vehicle stopped and the woman's husband confronted the driver. During the confrontation, a male passenger allegedly stabbed the husband in the back. He then got back into the Jeep and fled the scene. After traveling a few blocks, the vehicle stopped, and the female driver returned to the area and cooperated with deputies. The passenger fled on foot, but was located a short time later. The man who was stabbed was taken to a local hospital. The sheriff's office has not released more information about the 25-year-old suspect they arrested, but said he faces charges of assault, menacing, unlawful use of a weapon, and disorderly conduct. Rockaway City Manager Luke Shepard said everyone harmed in the incident is expected to recover. Mayor Charles McNeely emphasized that Rockaway remains a safe and welcoming place because of the dedication of local law enforcement and the community members who look out for one another. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has announced that $1 billion in federal funding will be available to states, local governments, territories, and tribes for projects intended to protect communities from potential natural disasters. The money is being made available through the Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities Grant Program, also referred to as the BRIC Grant Program. In a statement, current FEMA Administrator Karen Evans said that when done correctly, mitigation activities save lives and reduce the cost of future disasters. The BRIC program was started under the first Trump administration, and last year, the Trump administration abruptly halted it. At the time, a FEMA spokesperson said the decision was part of an effort to eliminate waste, fraud, and abuse. Yesterday's funding announcement comes after FEMA lost a lawsuit brought against the agency by a coalition of states, including Oregon, that claimed the agency's decision to halt the grant program last year was unlawful. The federal judge who made that ruling has recently set deadlines for FEMA to reverse its plans to terminate the BRIC grant program and issue new notices of funding opportunity. Earlier this week, the Oregon Department of Emergency Management said it had received new information from FEMA about the status of the BRIC grant program and recipients who, last year, suddenly found themselves without funding that had previously been awarded, and faced uncertainty about additional funding that was set to come. Among these is Columbia Memorial Hospital, which is in the middle of a $300 million expansion project at its Astoria campus. The hospital landed a $20 million grant through the BRIC program in 2023. Hospital leaders say they are cautiously optimistic now, but still haven't received official communication from FEMA about the status of the hospital's grant. You can read more about this story online at kmun.org/news. Garibaldi Mayor Katie Findling resigned March 16th, citing concerns about legal and institutional risks created by actions taken by the City Council. Her resignation followed a lengthy executive session, a portion of the Council's meeting that is closed to the public. During this session, the Council reviewed documents exempt from public inspection. In her resignation, Findling mentioned issues with the council's current direction without going into specifics. She said she believes the council is going in a direction that, quote, creates legal and institutional risk for the city, and that she cannot, quote, in good conscience, lend my office to that course. Findling took over as mayor in late August 2023, following the resignation of Tim Hall, who was facing a recall campaign. When she took over, she'd been assisting with city manager duties on a part-time basis. She helped the city hire John Schempf as city manager, though his tenure lasted less than a year. Findling was elected as mayor in 2024, running unopposed. She was set to face voters again this November. Findling's mother, Councillor Sandy Tyre, resigned just a few days before. The council has only 3 members remaining, just enough to form a quorum. The remaining councillors voted to declare the 2 seats vacant and will be accepting applications to fill them until the end of the year. This story comes to us through a news partnership with the Tillamook Headlight Herald, online at tillamookheadlightherald.com. You're listening to KMUN. This is KMUN. In other news across Oregon, 4 years after it shuttered and almost 9 months after being deemed a Superfund site, the J.H. Baxter Wood Treatment Plant in Eugene is still well short of its deep clean phase. KLCC's Brian Bull explains.
For 80 years, the facility processed countless telephone poles, railroad ties, and other chemically treated wood products with mounting complaints of odors and contaminants. Today, the plant is a barren shell. Its tank farm is gone, and its workforce is down to 1 employee who runs the stormwater and groundwater treatment systems. Ann Christopher's the EPA's remedial project manager for the site. She says there's still extensive soil sampling to do on the property, which may go 30 to 45 feet deep, depending.
So that could take a couple years, and we do the remedial investigation and then combine it with what's called the feasibility study, and that's how we determine which technologies are the best to clean up the site.
Once a Superfund cleanup gets underway, it could still take decades and cost billions of dollars before the site is suitable for use again. I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Eugene.
The number of students attending virtual schools in Oregon has more than doubled in the last 10 years. Outcomes for students at virtual schools tend to lag behind state averages. Elizabeth Miller reports.
Oregon's high school dropout rate was 2.9% for the class of 2025. An OPB analysis of dropout rates at virtual schools found the majority of them had worse rates than that Oregon average. But that's not the case for every virtual school. Senecio Ulit is with Oregon Family School, which serves about 900 students across the state. Ulit says one key to making online school work is having everyone on the same page.
Everyone does need to buy into it, the student, the parent, and us. We're buying into it. Are they? And when they are successful.
State officials say virtual charter schools will be held to the same accountability standards as other schools under a new Oregon law. Oregon Family School had a 1.9% dropout rate. That's about 1 percentage point lower than the state. Elizabeth Miller reporting.
A group called Pride in Numbers is surveying Two-Spirit and LGBTQ+ adults across Oregon. Organizers want to use that data to shed more light on rural queer communities. Antonio Sierra reports.
The survey is sponsored by the Pride Foundation and supported by a coalition of organizations across the state. Although the responses are anonymous, Pride in Numbers is hoping to learn more about LGBTQ+ people who live in rural communities. J.D. Herman lives in Lakeview and is a member of the group's advisory team. He says rural communities are often undercounted and underrepresented.
What the project's been really cool about is just allowing people in rural areas to tell their story, whether it's good, whether it's bad. They just get a choice, like they get a chance to say something.
Organizers are working with local community members across the state to help spread the word. The survey runs through May 31st. The group expects to release its findings this winter. Antonio Sierra reporting.
Here in the Pacific Northwest, we're due for the Cascadia Megathrust earthquake. And when any large earthquake hits, one of the major concerns is a phenomenon called soil liquefaction. That's when ground shaking causes the soil beneath our feet to turn into a soupy, liquid mess. Now, a research team from Portland State University is working on a way to stop liquefaction before it happens. OPB Science reporter Jess Burns reports.
There's a small tent in an engineering lab at Portland State University, the heavy-duty type used to store things outside.
This is what I call the magic tent, where all the chemistry and all the reactions are happening.
PhD student Fadzai Svanai steps inside the magic tent with a bucket full of deep blue liquid. She places it beside a clear, chest-high tank filled with layers of white sand and silty gray-brown soil.
This silt layer is the one which is most common here in Oregon, Portland.
Svanai drops a hose into the bucket and starts a pump that will simulate in the tank what they want to happen underground. The liquid is a mix of nutrients, soil microbes, and blue food coloring to make the solution easier to track as it seeps through the sediment layers. That's where the real magic happens. When the liquid is in the soil, the tiny, hungry soil microbes will gobble up the nutrients and produce nitrogen gas.
So when you think about those microbes and what they're doing, are they burping or are they farting?
I think they're doing both burping and farting, yeah.
However you look at it, these microbes are key allies in an innovative new technique to prevent damage to buildings during major earthquakes. They'll guard against a phenomenon called soil liquefaction.
If you think back to the 70s and 80s kind of B-movies of quicksand, that's what we're talking about in terms of liquefaction.
Kayla Sorensen is a PhD candidate at Portland State. In these movies, the hero would unwittingly run into a pit of quicksand and get sucked in.
Can you imagine how a building would react if the ground underneath it suddenly turned into this substance?
Basically, it would tilt or sink. Liquefaction can happen when vibrations from an earthquake hit soil that's fully saturated with water. These saturated soils are most often found along rivers and waterways, where the water table is high. That's also where many cities are built. Diane Moog is a geotechnical engineer working on the project.
Here in Portland, we have a lot of structures in Oregon that were built before we had a real understanding of the seismic risk in the area.
One of the most concerning spots is the critical energy infrastructure hub in Portland.
It's where 90% of Oregon's fuel is stored or handled.
These so-called tank farms along the Willamette River are built on high-risk liquefiable soils. The state is taking steps to bring the tanks up to seismic standards. But if the Cascadia earthquake hits before that's done, emergency officials are expecting chemical leaks, fires, and a devastating disruption to fuel supplies. Again, Kayla Sorensen.
The one thing that we're really fighting against is time, because it is not a matter of if it will happen, it is a matter of when it will happen.
The team's microbe-based solution to prevent soil liquefaction relies on being able to decrease the amount of water in the soil, says project engineer Arash Khosrowshahr.
The idea is that for the soils to liquefy, you need to have 100% saturation. This method works by reducing that saturation ratio from 100% down to whatever level required for it not to be liquefiable.
So picture it. You have a building on liquefiable soil. You drill two shallow wells, one on either side, says Moog.
You inject the treatment on one side of the infrastructure and then do some extraction on the other side. You can induce that treatment solution to flow underneath the structure and react to the soils underneath.
The microbes that naturally live in the soil feast and produce tiny air bubbles that push the water out from between the grains of soil. Displace enough water, and voila, no liquefaction, no matter how big the earthquake. In a field test, Khosrowshahr says those burping microbes reduce the soil saturation readings considerably, below 95%.
About 2 weeks into the treatment, they dropped down and they stayed down for like 5 years.
Then they were able to retreat the site in 2025 to similar result, but their testing continues.
This method, if it works, with a big if, but if it does work, then it would have a real impact.
Because there's no lack of buildings in the Pacific Northwest that could use some shoring up before the next major earthquake hits. I'm Jess Burns, reporting.
You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. Turning now to Washington. Washington State will make heavy cuts to early childhood education and child care subsidy programs this summer. One bright spot in the budget, preserving long-term care for immigrants in the country legally. State government reporter Sarah Mises-Tan has more.
About 1,200 immigrants will have their long-term health care preserved through the state starting in July. Adam Glickman of SEIU 775, which represents healthcare workers, says these immigrants are some of the neediest cases.
You know, these are, in a lot of ways, the most vulnerable of the vulnerable, right? These are folks who, one, often moved here from war-torn countries, and they are seniors or people with developmental disabilities.
State budget writers admitted they had a tough task laid out for them. They faced the challenge of closing a $2 billion deficit. Lawmakers say this was partially caused by heavy cuts from the federal government to social service programs for immigrants and refugees. In Olympia, I'm Sarah Mises-Tan.
In Seattle, federal judges plan to appoint the region's next U.S. attorney, and they've chosen a panel of local lawyers to help. This comes as the Trump administration has clashed with courts and U.S. senators over some of its picks for top prosecutors. KEOW's Amy Radel has more.
The Trump administration picked Neil Floyd, a former immigration judge, to be Seattle's next U.S. attorney, but Senator Patty Murray made clear she would block his confirmation. Floyd is currently the top federal prosecutor in Seattle, but the district judges have announced they plan to appoint a new U.S. attorney as the law allows. This week, they named a panel of lawyers to vet applicants and make recommendations. It's chaired by Republican Rob McKenna, Washington State's former attorney general. Some judges' picks in other states have been instantly fired by the Justice Department. But federal judges in New Jersey recently negotiated with the DOJ to install a consensus candidate. I'm Amy Radel reporting.
Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Department. To read more local news, go to kmun.org/news. There you can also find podcasts of our daily news broadcast. Thanks for listening. The American Democracy Minute is coming up next.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. March 22nd, President Donald Trump tied ending the partial government shutdown to passage of the GOP's draconian voting bill, the Save America Act. It still doesn't have the votes. While the Save America Act has been described as a voter ID bill by its GOP backers, it's far more restrictive than that. It narrows the types of IDs which can be used and limits acceptable proof of citizenship documents. Additional documents would still be needed for the estimated 69 million married women whose name is different from their birth certificate. Rarely mentioned by mainstream news is the bill's elimination of universal mail-in voting, used exclusively in 8 states and locally in 15 more. Such requirements hit the elderly, the disabled, and rural voters particularly hard. Long lines at airport TSA checkpoints have added pressure on the administration to end the shutdown. Senate Majority Leader John Thune said Wednesday that he will force a vote this week on a voter ID amendment to the Save America Act, but offered no specifics. Democrats still demand changes to ICE enforcement policies. In a letter to senators, the Brennan Center for Justice noted that states have found almost no non-citizen voting, saying the Save America Act would, quote, block millions of eligible American citizens from participating in our democracy. We've linked to more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
This is KMUN.